Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a show podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. I am your host, Reggie Darden, and I am very excited to have the one and only Rich Hale on with me today. Gonna, you know, talk some Kenpo, get into, you know, his journey and, you know, whatever other items that decide to get onto. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting to speak with you. And so I, you know, usually kick things off with kind of giving my background, but I'll just keep it short. Well, I'm going to keep it kind of short and sweet because, you know, the listeners are here for the guest and not so much me. But, you know, we'll kind of get into it a little bit more as we go along. But brief history is that I started Kenpo in the 90s. I now have advanced ranks in both Chinese Kenpo and American Kenpo. And I also have an advanced rank in Capoeira. And not so advanced ranks in Taekwondo and Hapkido, and did a little boxing as well. So, yeah, that's the super brief brief version. And like I mentioned, as we go along, we'll probably throw in some other things as they come up. But yeah, that's me. So, you know, you've been on some other podcasts and, you know, I'm sure people kind of know your story. So I would say, let's maybe start with the just kind of the brief version of you know how Kenpo found you and you know when you got started and then we'll just kind of go from there.
All right, that's actually very poignant in my case as far as Kenpo finding me, because it did. I was studying. Very quick story. I had come down from Alaska. And I was hitchhiking through, and I ended up in Apple Valley, California, where I got a job working for the gas company. I was there for about 6 months, and I transferred up to Big Bear Lake. And on one of my trips back down to Apple Valley, Victorville, I saw a karate school. I had always wanted to study karate. So I went in and I signed up. I didn't know what they were. I didn't know the style. I didn't know anything. I knew it was called Blakup. Found out that was the name of the school and not the style. Well, back then we did not have colored belts. You had a white belt and you dyed it for each color. So I got my yellow belt, and when I dyed it, it kind of came out gold, kind of like Game of Death gold. And I feel that is cool. So I, you know, anybody who gets their belt, they don't want to take it off, right? So I leave the school. I'm wearing my yellow / gold belt at a gas station pumping gas. And this guy comes walking up and he goes, "You study karate?" And I'm like, "Check it out. Yeah." And he goes, "What style?" I said, "Blakup." I never heard of it. He said, "There's Taekwondo, Kenpo, Shotokan." I'd never heard of any of it. And he goes, "What do you do?" I said, "Well, we hit and kick people and stuff." He goes, "Well, I study Ed Parker's Kenpo." And Ed's karate, that did not sound oriental to me. It could not be a good system after some guy named Ed. And he goes, paraphrasing, "We got theories, principles, concepts." And I said, "Well, we hit and kick people and stuff." And here's what he did. He said, "Hey, do yourself a favor. When you get home, look it up in the phone book and just give him a call." Now, it wasn't that condescending like some people. "Oh, do yourself a favor." It wasn't like that. It was like a friend of mine genuinely wanting to do me a favor. He said, "Hey, man, just go look it up in the phone book." So I did, just because of the way he came across. Now, he was a brown belt in Ed Parker's Kenpo. And we met at a gas station out in Lucerne Valley, just on a whim. And so I called, and at that time, my original teacher, Richard Callahan, was running a school for Ed Parker in Colton, California. I was living in Big Bear, so it was a 50-mile trip one way to go to karate. But the moment I got there and I talked to him, everything went out of my head except wanting to study with that man. And I was with him for about 5 years before I moved back to Alaska again. And then the story goes on from there. But that's how I got into Kenpo. It was a guy at a gas station. Great man, if I could find that guy today. 54 years later.
Yeah, that's something that I love about these stories is especially with, you know, people that are, you know, kind of top of the food chain, the high ups, is I've been really surprised by how many people have, you know, made the art their life, or, you know, their career. And many of the people that I've talked to and heard stories of, you know, either weren't even thinking about joining a school, or, you know, they came in with a buddy and the buddy stopped coming, but, you know, they stuck with it, or, you know, they were.
Well, I knew I wanted to study karate. There was absolutely no doubt. When I was in Alaska, when I was, I think, 16, there was a man up there by the name of Katsunaka Tanaka, and he was the karate instructor at Alaska Methodist University. And I was an ice skater, and I skated a lot, you know, often 3, 4, 5 hours a day I would skate. And one night there was a hockey game, and I look up in the bleachers, and this Japanese guy was running the cheerleaders. But boy, he was sitting here going, boom, cheer, 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 cheer. And they're cheering, and I'm like, wow, that guy, he's someone. And my mom worked in the concession stand, and I said, Mom, who's that guy? She goes, that's not some guy. That's Mr. Tanaka. He's a karate teacher at the university. And I just looked at him and saw perfection. I mean, he was amazingly good then. And not long ago, well, I guess it's probably 4 or 5 years ago, I went to his 50th anniversary of his school in Anchorage. So he's stuck with it and still there, still teaching. And to this day, he is that picture of perfection in my mind. And I knew I wanted to do that.
Very nice, very nice. So getting involved, you know, doing, you know, since you had a passion for it, was the teaching side of it also kind of early on, or did you kind of take to that later on in the journey? Or
no, you've probably heard this a few times, is back in the 70s, there was a student teacher program where you really didn't have to pay if you taught. And that's what I did. I didn't originally sign up under that program, but I would say I'm more of a teacher than anything else. I love to teach. And from the time I started there, I would take people under my wing, and I would teach anybody beneath me and assist the people above me. I was everybody's favorite dummy. I got beat up on a regular basis, all the demonstrations and everything. And even to me, that was great, because that's part of learning. You know, there's no better way to learn a technique than to go home and go, okay, I got hit here, 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 and here. So I know exactly where the targets are.
Exactly.
So yeah, I started teaching from the time I was an orange belt. You know, back then, everybody had private lessons. I paid $30 a month. And then with that, you would get one private lesson a week. And that was generally given to you by somebody one or two belts above you. And it worked out really quite well, because when you think about it, even today, if I were to teach a yellow belt, I might overwhelm them with the details of what should be done. But if you have an orange belt teaching a white belt, they're probably giving them just the right amount of information to keep them moving forward without overwhelming them with things. So that's how we did it. It was that trickle-down theory. So we all got to teach. Some of us just took to it more than other people did. So yeah, I've been teaching since I was an orange belt.
I like that in that you know, when you're an orange belt, you're closer to, you know, the thoughts and the feelings and the experience of that brand new student that I don't know, does kind of make it a little easier to relate to them, or to, you know, kind of show them the way, because it's like, oh well, you know, I was at that point not that long ago, versus, you know, you got your, you know.
Oh yeah, they think you're amazing, as compared to an orange belt working out with a blue belt or a green belt. You know, then you're nobody and you're nothing and they're overwhelming you. But if you get to teach somebody of a lower rank and they look up to you and admire you, that's a feel-good thing. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody should have that. And that way the natural teachers will come out.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So when did it, when were you able to, you know, connect with Ed Parker and start, you know, learning from him, and you know, being out in Alaska, you're kind of disconnected from from the rest of us. So, you know, how did
you know? Actually, I have students now. Of course, like many of us, I have students that are scattered around the country and around the world a little bit. And I was just now, last week, I was in Guatemala, and my student was very surprised when I told him that I know you feel isolated all the way down here in Guatemala, but Guatemala is much closer to California than Alaska was. I said, I was further from Kempo than you are. And I said, however good I've become had a lot to do with how far away I was, because I didn't have the convenience of just asking somebody how to do something. I had to read the manuals. That's what I had. So I read them and reread them, and I would rewrite them into my own words, because I felt like Mr. Parker was very wordy at times and flowery with his language. So I would try to condense it without losing anything. And well, I'm really getting off subject there a little bit. I do that sometimes. But how I met Ed Parker was, as I mentioned, I come to California. I was here for about 5 years. I went back to Alaska. And my good buddy and I, Roger Thomas, who was a classmate with me in California, we went up to Alaska as brown belts and opened up our own school. But now I'm sitting there without a teacher at all, and I had some real questions. And it just popped in my head, well, who better to ask my questions than Ed Parker himself? So back then, the phone number was 411 for information. So I called information and I said, you have an Ed Parker in Pasadena, California? And they go, yes. They gave me his number. I called the number. Somebody answered the phone. And I said, can I speak to Ed Parker? And he said, speaking. I did not know what to say. I was all fine right up to the point that he was on the phone. And I said, Mr. Hale, or I said, Mr. Parker, my name is Rich Hale. I teach Ed Parker's Kempo Karate in Anchorage, Alaska. And he goes, who's your teacher? I said, Richard Callahan. I love Rich Callahan. What can I do for you? I go, well, sir, I know techniques. I know forms, basics, kicks, fighting. I can do that, but something is missing. And I don't know exactly what it is. What do you suggest I do? He said, you get on an airplane and you come see me. So I got on an airplane. I went down to see Ed Parker. I got the dog and pony show like everybody. He shows me the big cape that Elvis gave him. He showed me the secret gun cabinet behind the painting that he shows everybody. Took me to his office. We did stuff for the course of the day. And I'm like, wow, this has been great. I've met Ed Parker. I'm leaving. And he said, so when will you be back? And I thought, you want me to come back? I'm probably the worst karate student who ever walked through your door. Why in the world would you want me to come back? And I said, well, I was doing well at the time financially. And I said, you know, I can come down on a regular basis if you'll have me. So I started flying from Anchorage back down to Pasadena. About every 3 or 4 months to visit and train a little bit. I wasn't what I would consider a student. Well, then after I left Alaska in 1984, and I was living here in California again, after a couple of years of visiting sporadically, I got a Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock time slot at his house every week. So that's when, there's a lot of stories that go along with that as far as how I felt like I was really a student of Ed Parker's. But that's kind of the progression. And then after a couple of years of that, couple of years before he passed away, I kind of went off in my own direction, not anything separating from Kempo, just didn't go down and see him as often as I used to. And then, of course, he passed away and we're all on our own.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there any kind of maybe ideas of how you would think that he would be or how he would teach, you know, before you met him and, you know, after you met him and started kind of training with him? Was your perspective on I don't know, I guess his status or his presence? I guess it's a little, you know, different than it is now because he's, you know, got a very, I guess, higher position now than when you started. But just, was there kind of any things that maybe you were surprised about, you know, the way he was or the way he taught or?
Oh, sure. Sure. There's a lot of, I think, misconceptions in regard to how tough he was. Now, that doesn't mean he could beat people up really well, but a lot of people have the impression that if you crossed him, he's going to kill you type of thing. In all the hours that I have spent with Mr. Parker, he never, ever even hit me hard once. He would club me a few times, like if I'm doing something wrong, he would drop body weight into me so I would kind of buckle under, but there was no impact. There was no lasting anything. He was very safe to train with, extremely fast, unbelievably fast, especially for a man of that size. But people would say things. I remember one story that people would say, well, if anybody had ever dared challenge him on his material, he would become the chosen one and all that. We challenged him on his material all the time. I wish today he were around, I could challenge his material at a much higher level than I could at that time. But the difference was how a person may go about it. I never went into Mr. Parker and said, Mr. Parker, this technique doesn't work. I would go to Mr. Parker and say, Mr. Parker, for the life of me, I can't get this technique to work. Now he's not insulted. I'm not criticizing his technique. I'm saying I can't accomplish it. And then very often he would fix possibly what I was doing wrong, or I just wasn't at that time at a physical level that I was capable of doing that technique. You can think of it a little bit like gymnastics or ice skating, anything that takes a degree of physicality. Just because I know a technique and I can't make it work, well, that's like doing a backflip or a handstand. Right now, Reggie, you and I both know how to do a handstand. We just put our hands on the floor and our feet in the air. We know how. I can't do one. I certainly can't walk around on my hands. And some of our material is that way. It is a very physical technique. So I call it a window of opportunity on a lot of our material. When you're a beginner down here, you just can't do it. You can barely stand on one foot and you can't kick high. You're not flexible. You're not coordinated. And then at some point in your career, you're as good as you'll ever get. And you have that window of opportunity to do as many techniques, the technical ones, the difficult ones. And then you find yourself, now you're 50, you're 60, you're 70, 80 years old, and you'll again not be able to do some of the material. Well, it's just like anything else. My wife is an ultra runner. She runs 100-mile races. I'm a runner. There's no way in hell I could run a 100-mile race or even a 50-mile race. A marathon is about as best as I can do. So just because you're a runner and you're really involved in it, other people are more capable than some people. And there'll be a day that my wife will no longer run such long races. So then she'll come back down and start running shorter distances, just like some of our material. All that stuff about techniques don't work. Well, maybe it doesn't work against a knife anymore. Maybe it never worked against a knife. But that exact same technique might work really well against a push or a grab or a punch or a club. It just depends on how physically good you are at that technique that you know.
So as, you know, as Kempo was evolving and Ed Parker was, you know, kind of changing things up and refining things, was there an encouragement to challenge, you know, the techniques and the, you know, the principles and things that he was, you know, putting out there?
No, there was no invitation to challenge anything. You have to think of it this way, is that if I create a technique right now, I fully think it will work. If I'm teaching it to a student, I'm teaching it to them because I've done it, I've made it work, and I have faith in that. So he wasn't soliciting challenges. In fact, there was a lot of people talk about this concept of change. They overuse the word change. Mr. Parker used the word refine a lot more than the word change. And when he did use the word change, it would be like me right now. Let's say that I have a motorcycle. The one I happen to have right now is a Harley Davidson. I've had a lot of triumphs. So I'd be talking to a Harley Davidson person, and I am saying, well, you know, people need to change. They need to open their eyes. A Triumph is smoother, more mechanically efficient. It's this, it's that, all the great things I knew about a Triumph. So I'm not telling change from what I do to something else. I'm saying they should change from what they do to what I do. So when Mr. Parker was talking about change, he was talking about the hard style systems and the more, I'm going to relate hard style with narrow-mindedness, so let's separate those, but more narrow-minded people to open up their minds a little bit and consider what he had to say. He wasn't saying, take what I am doing and go change it. He did, in fact, one of his quotes was somebody asked him whether or not he thought his students would change the system after he was gone. And he goes, no, they won't change it. They'll refine it. They'll perfect it. So is that changing things? Yes, but I think a lot's to be said in how you say things and the words you use. Change is a pretty broad term. Refine, I think, is a more appropriate term.
Gotcha. So, you know, were there kind of times where you or maybe, you know, some of your peers were, you know, kind of questioned maybe something that, you know, that he put out there? Or, there's so much, you know, drama and politics and whatnot, and, you know, we're not going to get into that, but I'm wondering if there was, you know, any kind of thoughts of, you know, people not just taking up kind of, you know, everything that Mr. Parker said, that was just, okay, he's, you know, he put it out there and that's it. You know, did everybody kind of just fall in line, or were there any kind of thoughts of, maybe we should do this a little different? Or
Yes. Now, you have to understand today, when I was originally studying, Hut Planus was a fourth degree black belt. And he was the man who Mr. Parker chose to travel the country and set the standard on how everything was done. Huck was a very studious person. He listened to Mr. Parker's every word, memorized it. He was like a walking encyclopedia of the art. And then there was another man, Yosh Fiura, who was not a professor, but down in Pasadena, he was known as the professor. So when you're known as the professor, how many fifth degree black belts are out there? So in my era, there was very few real high level black belts. And most of them studied directly with Mr. Parker. So it was a lot closer knit organization. And there was a lot more uniformity. That's good in some ways and maybe not as good in other ways. Today, hey, there's some second and third and probably fourth generation black belts that are just astoundingly good. So the caliber of people that are out there today. Now, we all know, like you talk about politics and drama, we have a lot of 10th degree black belts in Kempo. Okay, some of them, most of them, well, the real ones, I think I know most of them, and I know their history. We've all been there together. We've all been involved for 50 years, 60 years. My gosh, Chuck Sullivan, probably 70 years or something in Kempo now. So then you got the other side of the coin where I've met people who have maybe attended a seminar with Ed Parker, maybe, maybe not, and they're wearing a 10th degree. And you say, so where'd you get your first, second, third, fourth? Well, why are you picking on me? I'm just asking. So there's a lot of charlatans. There's a lot of fakes. There's a lot of frauds. There's a lot of people that think, oh, I'll wear that American Kempo because Kempo is a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So they just put the belt on and wear it, get their picture taken. They don't train. It's where they get the same thing with Aldo. Master Ken was speaking at one of our events, at a Bob White event, and he was joking about this system and that system. Then he got to Kempo and he goes, so what is it about this 10 pound per rank gain that you guys have to have? And you should have seen the Kempo guys. It's not funny, man. I thought it was hilarious. Everybody thought it was hilarious, except the big fat black belts that,
yeah, sometimes the truth hurts.
The epitome of what you're talking about.
Yeah, the best jokes usually have a little bit of a truth to them. So
I forgot the point of our original question there. What was it?
Well, just curious if there were if you or
I know others. What I was going to say, like from the beginning. I'll give a good example of things that we questioned. And this is kind of funny now because as an orange belt, I would say I didn't like something. And it comes to, well, who are you? Well, now 50 some odd years later, I can say something, might not even make sense. And people go, ooh, Mr. Hale said that. Well, I could be completely wrong. But if you've been doing it for 50 years, they just assume you're somebody now. Maybe we do know more than some people do. But here's the quick story. I was doing clutching feathers with this middle knuckle fist. And this blue belt kept drilling me, and it was hurting. So I got angry, and I drilled him back. Well, I hit a rib, and I jacked up my finger for several months. And I went to Rich Callahan. I said, Mr. Callahan, it's my fault. I lost my temper. But I hit him with this thing, and I jacked up my finger. All he did was go, ow, and that hurt. And he's done. He's well. And he goes, well, we have an alternative way to do that. I go, what? How? He said, a vertical punch. And right then, as an orange belt, I thought, why isn't a vertical punch the way to do it? And why isn't the middle knuckle fist the alternative way? Because there's not an orange belt on the planet that has developed a middle knuckle to the point where they could actually hit something with it without hurting themselves. I proved that out once I was down in Chile. And I had a bunch of high level, you know, third, fourth, fifth degree black belts. And they're good fighters. You know, they're good, strong martial artists. And we had that little card table, the heavy, stiff cardboard table. And I picked it up, pulled the legs in. I walked up in front and said, here, rip through it, middle knuckle fist, rip through. Don't worry about the table. I'll pay for it. No, no, master, no. No, no, do it, no, master, no. Why? I'll hurt my hand. I go, you're right. We would all hurt our hand trying to punch through a cardboard table. So what makes us think we're going to go out into battle and actually use that on a human body? And it's one of those things that it is a great weapon if you choose to develop it. But if you don't choose to develop it, all you're going to do is hurt yourself when you hit with it. So I had thought that for the longest time. So everyone has that. And then as time has gone along, in my own, when I'm teaching that to people today, I do teach it differently. I teach it as a punch. And then I say that is an alternative way. If you so choose to develop that into a weapon, you can do it. Well, there's a lot of people that are doing that. And as I've traveled the world in doing this, it's like more and more people. Remember the old spoked wheels, like bicycle wheels and motorcycles had spokes? Well, I would say that, like, say, the number of techniques we have. A lot of people think that's too many. But you go down, let's say you got a wheel, and you've got six spokes. That ain't enough. Your wheel's not going to work. Now let's say you put 500 spokes. Well, now you got a big, heavy wheel. It's probably not efficient. So I can say six spokes aren't enough. 500 spokes are too many. The right number, I'm not sure. But when you travel all over the world, everybody pares it down to a similar number that they feel is an adequate number. They're doing that with all of our material. More and more people are saying, I like the extensions. But there's not time in a day for people to memorize. The system has grown. When I was studying originally, we had 32 techniques, and the extensions were only on orange belt, and it was called green orange. And those extensions were only maybe two or three moves, very simple. And Mr. Parker's point behind them is people were calling those extensions endings. And he didn't want them to be called endings. He wanted everything we did to extend. And these were supposed to be just samples. And we were all supposed to go back in and create our own. You know who Skip Hancock
is? Yes, yes.
Skip worked very, very closely with Mr. Parker before he passed away. And they were in the process of creating, I wouldn't say different extensions. They were doing what they were calling formulations, because what they wanted people to do was formulate on their own. And these were, again, examples. But the problem is, every time you give somebody an example as a younger student, they carve it in stone, and that's how it goes. So it I don't want to say it failed, but I said it had less success than his base techniques. It didn't achieve what he wanted. He wanted people to experiment and to play and to utilize their techniques as ideas. But when you're learning, that's really hard to do. You have a real tendency. And then the owners of schools, boy, it's really hard to have a school where you have 154 techniques, and then you've got, say, six black belts that are teaching all differently. So we have a tendency to standardize what we do, even though that is not what Mr. Parker really wanted. But it's part of having a business.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it gets kind of tricky. I kind of have a laugh at people that are like, oh, there's too many techniques or there's too much to learn. So when I started, we had 40 techniques each belt. And the school that I'm at now, we're on the 16 technique curriculum. And I was like, when my peers are like, oh, there's so much stuff to learn. It's like, I had to learn a lot more at this at the same belt. So, it's
Yeah, I look at the techniques like this. To me, they're like toys. Can you have too many toys? Can Jay Leno have too many cars and motorcycles? No, we all want to be Jay Leno. Leno's garage, that would be the most amazing thing. Well, I look at all of our techniques, they're all fine. You can double the number, it's fine. The problem comes when you have to memorize everything. It's just like in jiu-jitsu, there's certain types of techniques that I have a higher degree of flexibility than a lot of the guys that I train with. So there are certain types of techniques that are fitted well for me. And then there's other types of techniques that are not fitted well for me. And what I love about jiu-jitsu is you're not required, as a rule, in most schools, required to know technique one, two, three, four, five. What you have to do is say, for example, you need at a given level, you need to know how to escape from the mount in two ways. Then your next belt level, maybe three or four ways. The next belt level, five or six ways. Submissions, you have to know a couple arm bars. Now you need three or four arm bars. You need variation of the arm bars. You need transition into arm bars. So they're not saying which arm bar you have to do, they're just saying you have to have one. In Kenpo, unfortunately, so much of our material is this is exactly what you're doing, whether or not that one truly fits you or not. I'd rather have, if they want to have 500 techniques, have them. Just let me pick amongst them. Because you've done it yourself. Every one of us have gone out there and go, I like that one. That's a favorite. And you just eat it up and you want to practice it. You want to train with it. And then you're going to have other ones. Oh, won't name names like gift and return. But I did a thing once I said online, I said, let's everybody pick one technique out of our entire system we want to do away with. I said, I'll go first. I pick gift and return. Most people said, oh, I wanted that one. And another guy came on and said, I love that one. Okay. So if he loves it, good. I bet he's good at it too. You know, anything you love, you're going to get good at.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, the numbers and everything that we have, they're fine. We should just be allowed, though, to get good at those that we really choose.
Well, that's the thing that's great about Kenpo is that it is all of, it fosters being able to tailor it for the individual. And we're not just, all cookie cutter, robots. Like we can all take this information. We have the techniques, we have the principles, we have all these things, and I see them as the blueprint, the foundation, and not the, I don't know, not the law, so to speak. It's just those building blocks for making the various movements our own, and those techniques that we don't like, we can modify them or jettison them or change them how we need to fit the situation and to fit the individual. So.
You know, and talking about Mr. Parker and how he felt about the material. When I first started studying with Mr. Parker on a regular basis, I thought I was really good because every week I would go there and we would go over material. And he very seldom told me I was doing the technique wrong. What he would do is emphasize the principles. So no matter what I was doing, he would emphasize the principles in order to make me better at what I was doing. Well, for the longest time, I thought I was doing all the material correctly. And then I go look at the book and realized I am not doing what the book said. Nor did he care. That wasn't his concern. He himself would do techniques differently than he put in the book. And it's his book, and he wrote it, and he would still do it differently. And he would show different people different ways to do it. What he cared about, are you applying the principles of Kenpo to whatever you're doing? And that will sometimes be very self-correcting. Because if you're not applying the correct principles to what you're doing, it's not going to work no matter what you're doing. So that was his big concern. Principles was during my time. Now, when I don't know what he was like before I studied with him, but I think like most of us, when we first learn something, when I was learning delayed sword, they go, what do you do if somebody grabs you? You do delayed sword, and it will work. And clutching feathers, triggered salute, dance of death, twirling wings, leaping crane. When I was young, every one of those was a real tested technique you would do if you were attacked. Now, I wouldn't do any specific technique. You couldn't pay me to get into a fight and try to do an actual technique. But that's where you started. Now, Mr. Parker may have started more like that. He may have, early in his career, said, this is what you do. And that might be why in the 70s, I was taught, this is what you do if they attack you. I didn't really start learning anything about the principles of the art until I started studying with Mr. Parker. Maybe other teachers, Richard Callahan, my original teacher, learned the material from Huck. He would come by and teach it. When Rich opened up that school, or when Mr. Parker hired him to run the Colton School, he was not an Ed Parker Kenpo black belt. He wasn't a Kenpo black belt at all. He was just a karate black belt and a great fighter, well-known, great athlete. And Mr. Parker offered him a job. He said, I don't know your system. It doesn't matter. I'll send Huck by. He'll teach you. So he was actually a belt ahead of us in the beginning. Of course, he learned so quickly. He learned it much more quickly than we did. So we never even knew that he was learning it just in front of us. But I think because he was just learning the material, they hadn't reached that level of even teaching him that it was a principle-based art instead of a technique-based art.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So in my journey here, I am newly part of the instructor program at my school. However, I did teach capoeira for many years, but the teaching side for Kenpo is kind of newish for me. So I'm curious if you could maybe kind of talk about first kind of some of your early experience in teaching, and then kind of lead into advice for someone like me that's new in the instructing part, and just kind of some thoughts, tips, things like that.
Well, to me, one of the things in Kenpo that really unites us and is probably the weakest thing in Kenpo, many people talk that we're a technique-based system. I don't really believe we are. I think forms are the heart and soul of the art. Now, in all the time I was with Mr. Parker, I could do a technique this way or that way, and he would play with them and work with them. But when we did the forms, that's where he paid a lot of attention. And that's where he would say, no, that's not how it goes. It goes like this. Because the forms are basically the alphabet. And he knew what he wanted done. And if we look back at his manuals, how they changed in the 70s and the 80s up to the 90s, the techniques were always changing. And he was adding to the techniques. But you look at every one of the manuals, the forms never changed. Now, I don't agree with everything in the forms, but as a whole, that's really the glue that holds our system together. I think people need to pay a lot more attention to the forms. What I call it, you got to hold their feet to the fire. And as my original instructor, Rich Callahan, said, if you fail the form, you fail the test. And at the end of the day, the forms are something that I'm 72 now. And when I go through my forms and I'm twisting and turning and I'm going, damn, this is a physical endeavor. Whereas when I was 25 and 27 and 32, I just whipped through the forms. It was like they were nothing. I had a regiment every day that I went into school, and I put it on my marker board. I would do both long and short forms. I do longs, or I do the ones once, twos twice, threes three times, four times, five times. And I didn't know six at that time. So then I would do five times, four times, three times, two. And that's a lot of kata every day. And what I would do is I would erase them as I did it. And when class came in, they would look up, Mr. Hale, you haven't done all your forms. I go, I know. So tomorrow I would have to finish those and then do all my forms again. Now by Friday, I might have a bunch of forms still on the marker board. And they go, what are you going to do? You're going to come in and train all weekend? I go, hell no. And I erase the board. So every Friday, regardless, I'd wipe that sucker clean and I'd start over on Monday. But that's a lot of forms. You know, I would spend 45 minutes just doing forms every day. Now, I wasn't at that time doing them as correctly as I do them today, but I did them a lot better, a lot snappier, a lot quicker. You know, I had all that style going on. However badly I did the forms, I put a lot into them. But I think it's important that people maintain those forms. Get that right. And then don't go on. The biggest flaw that I see in Kempo or any other martial art is allowing people to take their mistakes with them to the next belt. I had a guy one time teaching somebody stance set. I go, why are you teaching him stance set? Because the short form one is horrible. So he can't do a neutral bow. And you're making him do all this other stuff. Why not just make him do a neutral bow? Make him do short form one. So I watch these tests and they go, okay, you got a lot to work on, but y'all passed. But you got to get better at this as you move forward. And they go, what's my next technique? But don't forget that. Yeah, I remember. I will. What's my next one? What's the next one? Once you've given them that belt and you tell them to be sure to go back and work on that, they're not doing that. They're looking at that belt. So make them get their material right the first time so that how can you have a good long one if you have a bad short one? And it just goes all the way. I was watching a guy. I had to ask them. I said, does your long form one have 45 degree angles? No, why? I said, well, I've asked your students. Half of them said yes, and half of them said, I don't think so, but they don't know. And then I watched when they got all the way up to green belt, and I think they were doing long three, he's screaming at his students, what are you doing? I taught you better than that. I'm thinking, no, you didn't. You allowed them to get away, but now you have this higher ranking person visiting your school and you're embarrassed. It's not your student's fault. You're the one that allowed them to perform badly all the way up to this level. So really, the technique-wise, you know, people do what they want to do with techniques, fighting, you know, that's a thing unto itself. But if you want to have good students, I believe, personally, they should be really good at those forms. If they're good at their forms, they'll be good at techniques. They will not necessarily be good fighters. Now, that's the other huge flaw we have in Kenpo today. Back when I was studying, I would say today, people want to come to class half as often, for half as long, and get their belts twice as fast. That's a problem. I was teaching at a school for a friend of mine, and he said, okay, here's the junior class. I want 10 minutes of warm-up and stretching, 10 minutes of basics, 10 minutes of forms, 10 minutes of techniques, and 10 minutes of fighting. That's 50 minutes. I say, you know, it takes 5 minutes to line these kids up, right? And they're always, I got a question. I said, I don't know why kids are allowed to talk so much. But I said, now, once I do say, okay, stop, line back up, you know, that takes another couple, 3 minutes. So we got like 15 minutes of class just trying to get these kids to line back up. I said, now that you want 10, 10, 10, and 10, and 10, what do I leave out? And he refused to answer me. You got to do the math. If you've got kids coming to class for an hour, or like a lot of people, 45 minutes, you got to have a realistic expectation of what your teacher is going to provide. Well, here's what happens today. Fighting doesn't get done. They'll play games, which I am absolutely against. I was at a school not long ago. They got a little obstacle course, and they're jumping around, and they're playing, and they're doing all this. And I go, what are they doing? Oh, that helps coordination. It helps balance. I said, so does standing on one leg kicking. And they're learning karate. But they're really, it's karate daycare. That's all that they're doing. So you have to sit there and make sure, like, if you want to have good fighters, you get to a point on the clock and say, we've stopped everything we're doing. Now we're going to fight. If you want them to be good at techniques, you're going to block out that time and we're going to do techniques. But realistically, techniques aren't going to look good without basics. So you got to have basics, you got to have your forms, you got to have your techniques, and you got to have fighting. So you have to establish how much time you're going to dedicate to those. Unfortunately, Kenpo fighters today, as a rule, I think they're extremely weak. And it's not like blaming the schools. Part of the problem is we had a certain amount of material. Well, now we have those 154 techniques plus extensions to every single one. We have a lot more sets. So we used to have coordination set, kicking set, star block, finger set. And now all of them have a two. Have another version of all this stuff. And they have people doing all kinds of sets that still can't do short form one. I believe there is too much material to teach everybody all that material in half the time.
I certainly kind of agree with the idea that there's been a softening or can relate to, you know, the rush, like you said, with getting the belts twice the time, but, you know, putting in half the work. I think kind of our society is kind of gotten to that point, and we need to kind of take it back a little bit and develop more of that, you know, that grit and that desire to really train and not just be a belt factory or
you know, it's real tough. Back when I was studying originally, very few people did it for a living, And some of the best places I've seen, like Paul Dye. Do you know
Yes,
Paul?
yes, yeah.
Paul has been teaching out of his garage now for 30 years, maybe more. And he's got some of the best Kempo students in the world because he has nothing to lose. He's not making a living. He's teaching people that want to learn. And it's a very difficult thing. Once you've said, I am opening a business, I have brick and mortar, I've got insurance, I've got a building, I got lights, I got all this to do, you have to make money. It becomes very difficult to fail a student because they'll probably quit. So they tend not to fail anybody ever. It's hard. And I don't have the answer. I definitely don't have an answer to that. I have friends that have amazingly good commercial schools. They have found the right combination. And as I've seen from most of them, they had their standards high in the beginning. And they kept them high. And they struggled for several years to become successful as compared to somebody that opens up and they're successful right away because everybody who comes there gets promoted and they're happy and they're moving forward. And I'm not a fan. I don't like pushing the black belt concept to everybody that you're going to be a black belt, black belt, black belt, hang their black belt with their name on the wall. I know it's a great marketing thing, but it's too much emphasis on that belt instead of on just the learning and appreciation of the art. But that's a tough one.
Yeah.
If I opened I teach in my garage. I have now for about 25 years. But if I opened a commercial school, I would have a very difficult time. I would probably end up making some compromises. I would probably pass a few people that I wouldn't have passed in my garage. Because here's how I also feel. You got to keep those doors open. And if I go out of business, I can't help anybody. And you would hope, and we've all said this, well, he's not a very good orange belt, but he's going to rock as a purple belt. And they sometimes do. And maybe they're a good blue belt. And then they're kind of a lousy green belt. But by they get their brown, they're good again. So you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You don't know how well they're going to progress. And I will use one really good example. I was the worst karate student in the planet. I was extremely inconsistent because I mentioned I lived in Big Bear. It was a 100-mile round trip for every single class that I took for 5 years. So I quit about every 3 to 4 months. I said, I'm tired of this. I have no life. I'm driving up and down the mountain all the time. And I'd quit. And then I'd be down, I'd visit. Oh, Rich, how you doing? You want to work out? Well, I do have a gi in the car. Then I'm all excited and I go for 3 or 4 more months. Then I'd quit again. So, I don't know. I was an orange belt for almost 4 years. Because I just kept quitting and all I wanted to do was fight and kick. I didn't want to learn any material. I really didn't learn my material correctly or even attempt to learn it until Roger and I went to Alaska and opened up our own school. Fortunately, Roger was a real legitimate brown belt who learned all his material. I was a probationary. Was it probationary? Not probationary. I was a, what the heck do you call it? I was basically a fighting brown belt. Rich let me wear a brown belt, but I didn't have a certificate for a brown belt because all I wanted to do was fight, and he didn't want me to look like a sandbagger by being too good of a fighter. So I would wear a brown belt, but my level was like purple or blue. So we opened the school in Anchorage, and then I found a need for material. So Roger taught me my material until AC Rainey came in, and then he took over as our head instructor and taught us what we needed up to black belt then.
Okay. Very nice, very nice. All right. Well, yeah, there's a lot of other things that I want to get into, but we'll have to save them for part two and three and four and
Okay.
However many other
Sounds
parts
good.
we get to in the future. But we'll go ahead and move to our lightning round, as I like to call it. So got a few little kind of questions to throw at you, and then we'll close
Sure.
out for the evening. But first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry, bad
No, no,
answer.
no. That's a great answer. That's a great answer. Some previous guests have given that. So, yeah, that's as good as any other. So, very nice. Second question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
I don't care about the sets at all, any of them. I think there's so much inside of our forms that, as Mr. Parker put it, he said to me that the sets are the appendices of Kenpo. So they're something else. So as far as the forms go, I think five is a beautiful form. I think six is a gorgeous form, but I don't do it anymore at all. It has too many. I'm not happy with our weapons techniques, our knife and gun techniques. I don't think they're really that good. And I don't want to practice a whole bunch of techniques that I don't think are very good techniques. So as much as I love the way the form looks and flows, I don't really do it. Form four, as most people know, Mr. Parker said, if you know form four, you know Kenpo. Unfortunately, a lot of people think, okay, I've memorized it. Well, knowing form four is more like having an Oscar award-winning actor perform a part instead of a B actor in a B movie read a part. So knowing form four is so much more in depth than what a lot of people interpret it. So four would be a favorite. And I would actually work my way down. There's favorite things I like about every one of them.
Gotcha. So, since you have your issues with six, have you had any thought or desire in either modifying it or creating your own?
Oh no. No, it's like, you know Angelo Collado?
Yes.
Man, I'll tell you, the best man, best forms man I've ever known in Kenpo, there may be better than him. I think his son AJ is really pushing him. But you watch Angelo do six, and that's a whole other level. He was a whole lot better at six than I ever imagined being. So I wouldn't say to change something because it's not my cup of tea. So no, I wouldn't consider any changes. But you know, another thing we haven't really gotten into is I do a lot of jiu-jitsu. And in doing that, you go back to that how much time do you have in a day situation. So I do fewer techniques today. Primarily, I do the forms, the techniques that are in those forms, the basics that make those up, the principles that they're founded upon. And then I have enjoyable techniques that I like to do that are not in the forms, but I don't really pay that much attention. My Kenpo today really is based on the forms a lot, and then integrating that with the BJJ. So that keeps my schedule quite full.
Gotcha. All right, next question. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. I enjoyed Staff Set. I loved it. That was probably one of the most favorite things I've done in Kempo. And my only regret is I don't have a video of me doing it, because I spent countless hours doing that. But overall, I remember from the time I met Rich Callahan, and I go in, and he said, "Do you have any questions?" And I go, "Well, do you do any weapons?" The old dial telephone, you know, the old heavy phone. He reached over and he grabbed that and he shook it in front of my face and said, "Anything in the hands of a martial artist is a weapon." To this day, I'm still afraid of telephones a little bit. So it just had in my mind that if you are a good martial artist, truly anything in your hands does become a weapon. I always wanted to do karate. I was never interested really. I love knives, but I wasn't ever interested in doing a lot of knives. I wasn't interested in clubs or the nunchaka or the staff. At least in the old days, we actually used a staff instead of a shower rod, but everybody to their own. But I appreciate them. I think they're fantastic. It's just not something that I ever really cared about.
Gotcha.
So no favorite weapons.
Okay, gotcha. Right, and then the final question, if there's anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Miyamoto Musashi.
Oh, nice one.
But then again, I'd probably die, so I don't know if he'd be a good choice.
not a bad way to go.
You know, really, I would say it's not within my style, but so it's not so much for the, oh, I want to learn something, you know, learn a technique or form, but to Gichin Funakoshi, Jigoro Kano, you know, these guys, that would be just to be in their presence, just to see them teach, to see what they were like and what they did. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Most of the Kempo guys I've already been with.
Yeah.
So there's not many of those.
Yeah, I've been realizing with that
opportunity
with
to
this,
experience.
I've been realizing with that question.
But, you know, I can add to that, though, Reggie, and just like a little bit of an offshoot of it is it's like, there are a certain number of instructors out there that I think everybody should have an opportunity to experience. Chuck Sullivan is just, to me, you know, the top of the food chain when it comes to having been there and known it and done it. Some people that I'm very fascinating, Tom Bleeker, you know, we talk about a journey. He's the one that created the term, writing the journey books. And I don't know how many people know the depth of his knowledge, what he's done in his life. He's a fascinating person. If anybody can spend some time with somebody like that, Mike Pick is another one that is just fascinating. Huck Planus, of course, is beyond words, what he knows. And what I love so much about Huck, he's an innovator, like many people are to a certain degree, but that was never his purpose. His purpose was to teach the Kempo that he was taught by Ed Parker. And it fulfilled him. He doesn't think there's anything new, which I agree with. There may be new ways of doing things, but there's nothing really new in regard to what Mr. Parker created as a system. So he's a great person to experience. There's a lot of people out there today. That Lee Wedlake is another one that's a good friend of mine who is just a storehouse of knowledge. I would leave probably too many people out if I went on and on about stuff like that, but there's a great number of people out there that I think everybody should look and see who is accessible to them, who lives in their region. A lot of times what people don't understand, as seniors, we welcome phone calls. We welcome people coming to see us or to call us and ask us questions to get us to know us. We're not untouchable. We're not out of reach. It's kind of like they always talk about a supermodel. They can't get a date because, oh, she won't go out with me. So nobody asks her to go out, that type of a deal. Not that we're lonely. It's just the idea that we are very accessible. And I don't know anybody. Dennis Kanatzer is another person who's just a wealth of knowledge and his stories and everything that he has, Mr. Parker and what he's done. Again, I've already mentioned, like, Skip Hancock is amazing with the knowledge. And then I would say one of my favorite instructors today is Angelo Collado. If somebody has an opportunity to study with Angelo, every single time I watch Angelo teach, I learn something. And it also, on occasion, reinforces something that I either know or thought I knew. There's a lot of great people out there. They just need to reach out to these people and make their acquaintance.
Yeah, I really like that you said that about, you know, yes, the you know, these teachers are accessible. One of the things, you know, in starting this show was, you know, I thought, you know, okay, I'm not going to be able to talk to all these people, and
you'll see they're very well. John Sepulveda, of course, you've probably talked to, is a wealth of knowledge. Another one of my absolute favorite people that I'm always just amazed, not only with what he knows, but how well he communicates it. And that's Brian Duffy down in Texas. You know, my own instructor, A.C. Rainey, very accessible to people, one of the nicest people on the planet, and a wealth of knowledge. And it just goes on and on. I should, like, come prepared, but it would take the hour just to read.
No. I totally agree. A lot, you know, many of the people that you mentioned and a lot of the big names, when I, you know, announced I was going to be doing the show, many of them were the first people to say, yeah, I'll be on. And, I've been really, you know, blown away by that and really thankful, because, you know, I want to get that information, you know, not only for myself, but, share it with the others. And, but kind of what you said also made me think of something that we say in the Capoeira world, it's something that, you know, says, kind of, I'll kind of paraphrase it, but it basically says, you know, if you're hungry, go eat. And it basically means that, you know, if you want this knowledge, you know, you have to go out there and get it. You know, you seek it, you know, you'll get fed, you'll get that knowledge. And, I would, you know, definitely encourage the listeners out there to, you know, to go out and reach out to these teachers and get that deeper understanding of, you know, not just Kenpo, but the arts themselves.
You know, right. I just had a thing where it was on Facebook here recently where I was visiting with a friend of mine up in Oregon, Dan Anderson. Now, he was called Super Dan back in the time. An amazing, great fighter. And I was in Alaska. I saw him on the cover of Karate Illustrated. And I looked at him. He's just a normal looking guy. And I saw he ran a printing press for a living. I thought, well, I got a friend of mine who runs a printing press. How can you really be good at karate standing there all day running a printing press? And I decided to jump on an airplane, fly down to Oregon, and meet him. So I met him, and we trained and worked out together, had a great time. And now it was almost 50 years later. My wife and I were up in Oregon a few weeks ago. We stopped in and had a wonderful evening with Dan and his wife. And it isn't just limited to Kenpo. Like, Mike Stone is one of the coolest people out there. Fumio Demura, before he passed away, a very gracious man. I have never Bong Soo Han, Heal Cho, all these guys that I've stopped in and just met and visited who's, I'm not even in their system or style, and they're very gracious. So people are missing some wonderful opportunities if they don't just look around and find somebody and give them a call, write them a note. You know, you got Facebook. Reach out. And, you know, the mistake a lot of people make today in, like, on Facebook is they want to friend somebody, but they don't write them. When I friend somebody, I write them and I tell them why I want to be their friend. You know, either I've seen them, I admired them, or I saw we had common interests. They might be a green belt in Kempo. But I say, oh, you're a hiker and you're a trail runner and you scuba dive. Gee, we're already friends. Let's just get to know each other. And then I will have actually been traveling around the country and meeting these people. Here's a fun one I did once. I was going to Australia. And just as a joke, I said, as a man, I'm going to Australia to find the best beer because we all know that Foster's sucks. So I had people meeting me at the airport and buying me beer. I'd go to lunch. I had six beers lined up in front of me. And the people, Mr. Hale, which was the best beer? And I went, I don't know. It was a joke. After two beers, they all taste alike anyway. But when I had opened up that invitation, people were coming out of the woodwork. And that's fun. I love meeting people in Kempo. And I don't have to meet other high-ranking black belts. Just any and everybody that wants to be part. I've had them actually come out to the house and stay and train and visit, just like I did with Mr. Parker. You know, it was an amazing thing being with him in that there was a lot of stories. I mean, we could spend several hours just on the stories of Mr. Parker alone, but he never charged me for lessons at all. And one day a guy comes in. When I got there, he was there, and he's signing a check, gave it to Mr. Parker, and I thought, oh my gosh, am I supposed to pay? He never talked about it. He never said anything. He just invited me back. So I went up to him and said, Mr. Parker, am I supposed to be paying you? And he goes, Rich Hale, I have two types of people who come to my home. I have my students, and I have those who pay me for lessons. You're of the first category. Yay, yay, yay. Now, I also realized he had real students that paid him. Why he didn't ask me to pay, I don't know. But I look at it in the same way. I don't charge everybody for everything. If somebody wants to come out and just visit and train, I'm not going to say, yes, it's $200 or something to come in, which is what that check was for. 40 years ago, that's pretty good wages. So, yeah, there's a lot. People ought to take advantage of their opportunities and meet one another and put it out there because there's a lot of great people. Also, people all over Europe and, you know, all over the world. There's some amazing Kempoists out there today. We've grown.
Yeah, yeah, no. Anybody that doubts that you know, all these various teachers are inaccessible, let me be an example of they're very accessible because I've done a lot of Facebooking since I started this show, and I wouldn't have a show if folks weren't responding back. So. Yeah, don't be shy with reaching out to these folks. So.
Got to tell you a real quick one, just because it came to my mind. I was down in Texas and I was visiting Lee Wedlake, and we go out to lunch. And when the check came, I reached for my wallet, and Lee said, "Rich, your money's no good in Texas." I go, "Wow, thanks, Lee. Can we go car shopping?" And he looked at me like, should have known. No, we didn't go car shopping. But,
okay.
But, you know, especially Lee is really a great one.
Yeah.
Really fascinating. He's very studious. he took notes, and he has wonderful books out there, especially Lessons with Ed Parker. And I recommend absolutely everybody pick that book up.
That is a great book.
That's true insights there.
Yeah, that's a great book.
And it's kind of, I wish I could, you know, please forgive me, all you guys whose names I didn't mention, because you and I will hang up and then I'll go, oh my gosh, I didn't say this guy, and that guy, but it's just a sampling. I think everybody understands.
We'll be sure to bring them up in part 2 and 3 and 4.
Yeah.
All right. So now is your time for shameless self-promotion. So you can say anything you want, plug anything you want, anything else that you want to get out there before we end for tonight. Now you have the floor to say whatever you like.
Well, I have no promotions. I'm shameless when it comes to any of that. I'd be fine, but in putting in things, I have a favorite Ed Parker story I've told before. I would get to the house. It was Wednesday mornings at 10 o'clock. I would wait, and I'd look at my watch. And when it hit 10 o'clock, I would knock and say, come in. So then I'd come in. I don't know if I knocked early or if I was a minute late, but that's Ed Parker. So I always made sure I hit it. So I knew exactly when I got there every day. So I go in one day, and Mr. Parker has a knife in a sheath. And he goes, I think today we work on knives. And I'm thinking, I don't want to. This does not look good for me. Well, then he puts that big old knife down, and he had the scabbard. And then he got blue chalk, and he put it on both edges of that scabbard. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to die. I'm good. Then he handed it to me. He said, stab me. Well, I've already gone through the time when Mr. Parker said, hit me. And you know what it's like, really? You got a guy waiting for a fastball, and he throws a little underhanded, and you can't hit it. Well, it's the same thing in karate. If you don't actually throw an attack, it's hard to defend against it. So I knew when he said attack, he meant attack. So I get this thing. I'm like, you're a big man. I cannot miss you. It's going to be embarrassing. I'm going to stab you with this scabbard. Boom, I go in. Swoop. He took it, and he is attacking me, and I'm defending. And he stopped. He just goes, so how do you think you did? I said, I think I did good. He says, I think you should look in the mirror. So I go to the mirror, and I had a blue streak here, 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 and there. And I just looked and went, ha. I had enough. And he said, I think this is enough today. What do you think? So I left. I don't know if I said goodbye. I got out on the sidewalk in front of his house. And I looked, and it was 10:02. In 2 minutes, I had the most humbling, best karate lesson of my life. And I think what Mr. Parker would do regularly is humble us. Because you start thinking you're pretty good. And he would show you what good really is. So that type of a thing was, I'd say, the greatest blessing of being with Ed Parker, is to truly see unimaginable how good he really was. And today, people look and they love him for who he was, what he did. He knew Elvis Presley. You know, you can't even buy a Kimpo patch without seeing on eBay the Elvis patch. I don't even mention Ed Parker. But to have been there with him and to see the kind of person that he was fascinating. Here's a real quick one, Reggie. You got plenty of video, right?
Yeah, we got plenty
of tape. This weekend, I'm going to the Martial Arts History Museum. And Michael Masuda, who founded it, heard me telling a story one day. And what it was is I installed an alarm system in Ed Parker's house. That's what I did at the time. I was an alarm technician. I saw this cool stuff. I said, Mr. Parker, you know, I want to thank you for all you've given me. How would you like me to put an alarm in your house? So long story, so I'm putting the alarm in there. And I went through every cupboard, every closet, every place you can imagine running wire inside of his house. I got it all finished, and he goes, "What do I owe you?" I said, "Mr. Parker, I would never take money from you." And he goes, "You say you never take money from me. Then what would you take from me?" I said, "I saw some stuff in the basement." He goes, "What stuff?" So I go down. It's sitting here. Let me grab this right quick. So I go down and I come back up with this uniform. Now you can look at how not detailed this is. This is one of Mr. Parker's uniforms. And it was in the basement. And I come up, "Well, how about this?" He said, "Give me that. That's one of my favorite uniforms." And he put one arm in and he walked in circles. He couldn't reach the sleeve. He goes, "Take that one. Never liked that one anyway." So that's one of the things I got from him. And I'm going to give this to Michael this weekend at the museum. So he has a lot of uniforms from a lot of famous martial artists. And he does not have Ed Parker's. So I'm going to give him an Ed Parker uniform this weekend.
Very cool.
It's a special appreciation week for Michael himself at the museum. So a lot of us are going to go honor him and all the work he's done for everybody. And that's when I give away Ed Parker's uniform instead of, I have no idea what I could get for it on eBay. And I've got pictures of him wearing the uniform as well.
Oh, very nice.
And then, of course, if anybody ever questions anything, just ask Edmund.
Yeah.
Because Ed Parker Jr. was there pretty much every time I was there. And he knew exactly who's who in the zoo, as they say. Mm-hmm. So that's a fun one.
Excellent.
This is the last I'll ever get to see the uniform until I go to the museum.
Very nice. Very cool. Very cool. I thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me, and I'm looking forward to getting this out for everyone to hear, and we will definitely have to do this again at another time. But yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.